Couple thoughts go through my mind. Number one is, so what are you thinking? Having me come back again, are you, wow. Second thought is, maybe you wanted to hear about 2 Corinthians, because frankly, 2 Corinthians is one of those books in our Bibles where the pages are still stuck together. You know, we pastors preach through 1 Corinthians all the time, but they never quite get around to 2 Corinthians. And folks, what makes this so fascinating of a book is that it's actually number 4 out of Paul's letters. It's not his second letter. And folks, this is, how would I explain it to you? It's kind of like you take all of Paul's hardest experiences and you pack them into 2 Corinthians, and this is where we kind of get, really the distillation of his greatest insights about life, about pain, and we get things like this marvelous passage today, looking at God with unveiled faces. So, first thing I thought is, what were they thinking, wanting me back here again? Second is maybe they wanted to really dig into 2 Corinthians, but then you didn't know I was going to be talking about 2 Corinthians. So the only other reason that I thought I was asked back again is because Daniel really doesn't have many friends. Yeah, so, you know, his list is very, very short, so I got the call back again, and I am delighted to come here today. Have to say, during that last song, was I the only one that started to shiver when I saw all that snow? I'm cold, and that snow just made me colder. I'm just saying there. Well, Pilate walked out of his chambers, and you got the sense that he was trying to somehow finagle a way to release Jesus. Can't do it. Walks out and says, "Behold the man." Now that phrase, "behold the man," it's been repeated so often that it has a devotional, almost a lingering power of our lives. In Latin, it became ecce homo. Behold the man. So you go to Jerusalem today. There's the Ecce Homo Arch. I've stayed in the Ecce Homo Convent and Airbnb. But in Spain, beautiful sunny Spain, in the 1830s, in the village of Borja, at the Sanctuary of Mercy Church, they built their new church and they wanted something that was beautiful. And there was a guy, Elias Garcia Martinez, who's a painter. And year after year, he had come to Borja, and the people of the church had treated him so nicely. So he said, "I'll paint you a mural." And he paints this beautiful mural, and it's called Ecce Homo. And it is. It's gripping. But you can see that the mural was having some problems over time in the Mediterranean climate, not far from the sea. It began flaking off. What to do about it? And there was a dear saint in the church, Doña Cecilia Jimenez. And she was watching the beloved painting flake away. And so one night, she bought some paints. And she went inside the church, and she fixed it. Yeah, you know where this is going, don't you? Let me show you. Well, in Weight Watchers, you have before and after photos, right? Usually, the after photo is pretty good. Yeah, look at this. Oh, can you? Can you imagine going to church on a Sunday morning, you know, your beautiful chapel, and the organist starts and the little cute candlelighters come in and light up the church, and you go, what? This happened? Can you imagine a board meeting after that? What are we going to do? How do we fix that? Problem is, the word homo in Spanish sounds a lot like the word mono. And mono means monkey. Ecce homo became behold the monkey. And that's what the church is known for. I told Leanne, my wife came along here today, I told her that I was going to be using this, and she said, why? What are you thinking? And I said, because for me this fits Romans chapter 5, where Paul is talking about how through Adam, sin has affected us all. And that idea that all mankind has been affected by sin and it's changed every one of us. I said, this is a little bit like that for me, because you can kind of see a little bit of the same picture, but something has happened along the way and it's not quite right. Now, the problem with the whole idea of through Adam we sinned all, theologians took that, and as they thought about it, they go, yeah, even babies are born with sin. And they had these long conversations about how babies are born with sin. And it's weird when you read about what has transpired as people have talked about babies and sin. And I think it caught on with people because for some reason it affected our guilty conscience, and it certainly made the case for infant baptism. But I can't go all the way with that. I don't think that babies are born with sin at all. I think what happened through Adam is that something took place inside of us, and our default, our inclination, is to all rebel and to turn our backs. And in trying to get my mind around it, have you ever been in a house of mirrors? You know, at carnivals, you go into this house of mirrors, and you walk in, and well, so much of it, we look right, you know, tall, good-looking, beautiful, except there's a warp in the mirror, and all of a sudden, my size 9 shoes are now 6 feet long, or my head is like larger than my torso. I think that's what sin does to every one of us, that through Adam, it introduced a warpage, like a funhouse, into every one of our lives. Because while we have problems with sin, still we are created in the image of God. Think about that. We are somehow shaped, understood, designed for greatness. But we have this problem with sin. And Paul says in Romans chapter 5 that through Adam, that affected every one of us. But it's interesting, when Jesus and Paul were writing, what they were creating was not creating another religion that is all about becoming better. They weren't creating a moral reformation religion. It wasn't about sin management, that if I get better and better and better, then when I die, I get to go to heaven where I'm going to play a harp throughout eternity. That seems to never be in their understanding. What is in their understanding is that I go through steps, and I'm going to want to go to the next slide here. Paul talked about disciplines. Paul talked about going into training. Not so that we would somehow get nicer and holier. Those are byproducts. How he viewed it is that, yes, we all have this problem where there has been a warpage. But as we go into training, God begins to prepare us even right now through his Holy Spirit so that we are going to be ready when the new heaven and the new earth come together, that we're going to be part of his reign in a new Eden, in the new heavens and the new earth. And I don't know about you, but that changes everything for me because I don't think about just going to heaven when I die. What they're saying, even in Romans 5, and then now we're going to be seeing it in 2 Corinthians in chapter 3, is that God is all about creating and restoring and reclaiming a heavenly humanity. And it's not like we wait until we get to heaven before it happens, but it is happening right now. And Paul is going to be talking about that. And what I want to do now in going to the passage, all of that was background to get you up to speed a little bit. I want to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Next slide. And folks, this is where it gets fun. Now, Mike, when you were reading for me, I really appreciate that. But there were so many glory this and glory that, it seemed to all kind of flow together. And it was hard, even, I've been studying this passage the last week, it was hard to get my mind around it. Well, let me give you a handhold. What we see in this passage is something that if you were a Jewish person growing up in Jewish arguments in your house, you would be very familiar with it. It's called Kal Vachomer. And it was a way that Jewish people argued and they debated with each other. It literally means lenient and strict, but how it works is that, well, if this is true, then this must really be true. And to this day, you're standing on street corners in Jerusalem and you will see old men talking to each other using this same approach. And you know what? George Costanza's father in Seinfeld, he was very, very good at this. And here's what it would sound like if you were talking to your teenage son. Well, son, if you don't turn and look in the eyes of your friend when you're playing video games together, you're kind of dishonoring them. Well, if that's how your friend feels, then imagine how your mother feels when you ignore her when she's talking to you. You see what Dad's doing? He's going from less to more. Well, now, that's what's going on in this passage. And when you see this repeated three times, this raises it up to the level of the Richter scale. Because in Hebrew scriptures, you don't have any exclamation points at the end of sentences. You don't have any way to underscore it. So what you do is you repeat, and you take a way of arguing, and you really, really ramp it up. So let me show you this. Verse 7. Now, if the ministry that brought death came with glory, will not the ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious? Okay, this is your part. What you're supposed to say at this point is yes. Okay, let me say that again. What you're supposed to say at this part is yes. Yes. Okay, yes, good, good, good. So that was the first one. Here's number two. And if the ministry that condemns men is glorious, how much more is the ministry that brings righteousness? Now this is where you're supposed to say, much more. Much more. Good. Oh, you're a great audience. Here's the third. And if what was fading away came with glory, how much greater is the glory of that which lasts? Much, much greater. Okay, what happened? My timing. I have no timing as a comedian. This is where you're supposed to say, much, much greater. Okay, now we got it. So you have the idea going. If this is significant, this is much greater. And what Paul is talking about, he is using a word, it's a church word, and we toss it out so frequently that we don't get what it really means in its world. It's the word glory. We say somebody's going home to glory. Well, we shouldn't take any glory, we shouldn't draw any glory to ourselves. You've heard that. Glory means light, radiance, incandescence, but it also means fame. It also means turning the lights on us. But it also means weight, heaviness, gravity. It's like when somebody turns a really, really bright light on you, what do you say? Oh, that hurts. There's a heaviness. There's a weight to it. All of that was involved in glory. And Paul is talking about glory, and he's making a comparison between glory in the Old Testament and then glory that's come about from Christ. And folks, got to tell you, we get lost in this because his arguing is so dense, and that's too bad because where he's going, oh my goodness, it's going to be great. But I've got to take you back to the Old Testament for one little bit more. Exodus 32 to 34. Let me paint the scene. This is Mount Sinai. You see it, right? Can you picture it? Here's Mount Sinai. Parked out in front of it is a giant campground. Thousands upon thousands of people. Moses has gone up to the top of Mount Sinai, and he has gotten the commandments, and on his way coming down, he hears music. And he sees that what all of the people are doing, they're dancing, but we don't pick it up. It feels to us like, oh, they're just having a high school dance. This is something much more in your face to God. This is a giant, like, middle finger to God saying, we don't want you. We want this. And it's at that point that God says, okay, I'm done. Finito. End of the experiment. And Moses steps in and he says, God, you can't do that. And actually, he's going to also say this three times. God, you can't do that. God, don't do this. There's got to be another way. God, don't do that. And this is where Moses, he hatches an idea. Because he understands that if God removes his glory, then the whole experience of being the Israeli, the people of Israel, the children of Israel, it's going to be a wash. It's going to go away. And we're just going to have graves in the desert. There's no future for us. Moses says, in essence, God, I have a plan. How about if your glory rests on me, if you will share some of that with me? And the text tells us this kind of crazy or weird picture that it's hard for us to get our minds around, where it says that Moses wraps himself in some sort of a textile. And we read that and we think, oh, he's afraid that when God's glory comes down on him, this light, this radiance, this incandescent, he's afraid that it's going to go away. And we're missing it. What he's really doing and why he wraps himself in this is that he understands that if God's glory spills out over the edges and falls on the people, to a stiff-necked people, it'll wipe them out. God's glory is that powerful of a thing. Moses wraps himself in this as a way of containing God's glory until God creates the tabernacle or specifies the tabernacle and the Torah. When those two things come about, the glory of God shifts over onto them. And then Moses can retreat back into the back of the picture. Here's why I bring that up. And here's how it relates for the passage. Because in Corinth, what was everybody concerned about? Glory. It's a Middle Eastern culture, so it's all about honor and shame. Now, if you've never lived outside the United States, it's hard to understand how much this just drives everything. People want to attract as much notoriety, as much popularity, as much recognition, as much fame as they could. Okay? Huge, huge cultural value. And to avoid shame. They wanted glory. They wanted to be known. They wanted to be recognized. And Paul, folks, has just gotten beat up time after time after time for not having enough glory. Paul, you're embarrassing. Your job, you're doing blue-collar work. And we want the leader of our faith to be a champion, to be somebody who has glory. And Paul, you don't have enough of it. You're not that great of a communicator. You don't have success. We bring our friends, and they're not impressed with who you are, Paul. And that's why we want to listen to these new leaders. And Paul put you out to pasture a little bit. You see, what he's going to be saying here is a very, very practical lesson for them. And he's going to be talking about how the glory that Jesus Christ brings about in our lives, it's a whole lot greater than the glory that drives almost everybody else around you. The glory driving most of the people in Corinth, it was like dollar store candles. You know the kind of candles you'd get at the dollar store? Yeah, you light them and the wick isn't long enough and the little bit of wind, they're gone. But if they happen to last a little bit longer, it's just a few minutes and they collapse into wax on the floor that the janitor has to clean up. It's not good. His point is that the glory that all of you folks are seeking, that you're comparing me to, it's not all that. And when you think about glory, he goes, even the glory that was significant in our past, Moses wrapped around with the towel, the tabernacle, Torah, those are like 60-watt incandescent bulbs compared to the real glory that's out there. So you get that idea? Dollar store, 60-watt incandescent candles of their past. He's saying there is a glory that is waiting for you that is beyond anything that you can imagine. So much greater, so much grander. And this is where he's talking about, like, where I began. Because clear back in the Old Testament, God says, I'm going to use you to be a kingdom of priests. I'm going to use you to be my partners for the blessing of all nations, Genesis 12. And I talked a little bit earlier about how God invites us to be his partners. That fell apart out in the Sinai desert. But plan B comes about in Jesus Christ. And God is going to raise us up. And there will need to be no towels, no textiles in between us. That God has a glory for you that is going to be it is going to be beyond anything that you can imagine, because God isn't just going to take us to heaven when we die. He is once again intending to share his glory, because we will join him in his reign, in his management of the new heavens and the new earth. Now this hits me in a couple different ways. The first is, when we think about glory, we think about light. My wife and I moved into a new house. And across the street from us, the owner of it has one of those motion-sensing lights. You know what I'm talking about, that you walk out on the street and it's, you know, just lights everything up and it blinks. What's it saying? Stay away, you're getting too close. Danger, Will Robbins in danger. You know, stay away from this. It's a warning light. And Paul is saying, the Old Testament, the temple, they were all about warning lights. They were good. There's nothing wrong with them. They were good. But they were just warning lights. There's another neighbor around the corner a few blocks. And what they did is that instead of sending off warning lights, they designed their entire house. And let me see I want to show you a picture of it here. Maybe not. Yeah. Okay. So the first one, the first one at the top is glory is warning. That's the light going off across the street. The second is glory is invitation. These folks design light not to keep people away, to invite them in close. The Old Testament, the tabernacle, they were about how do we deal with our sin. They were warning. Paul is saying there is a glory that God has intended for you. And it's not going to be about warning. It's an invitation to join him in what he is doing throughout all of time. Let's go to the next slide. Those initials ring a bell. Handel would write them at the top of each piece of music that he would write. But he wasn't the only one. So did Johann Sebastian Bach. Soli Deo Gloria. Soli to the glory, only to the glory of God. I love that because there was a group of composers who understood that what they were doing in their writing of astounding music, they were joining in and partnering with God even before their death because they saw God as doing something far beyond what most people saw around them. Soli Deo Gloria. And where I want to go with that, folks, just in wrapping it up a little bit, is I would encourage you to take on that same sort of idea for your life. I've got a guy I meet with every Friday. He's a barber. People come and he's sitting in his chair. He's like 28 years old, tatted all up. He's got places I didn't know they could put tattoos. And he was talking about his life and all these people sitting in his chair. And I said, Jacob, you do realize that every person who comes and sits in your chair, in a sense, you're the priest for them. They'll say things to you that they won't say to other people. And if God has placed you in a barbershop like that, then you're to cut hair to the glory of God. The glory of God isn't about preaching sermons in churches. It's about taking the glory of God to your mission, to your vocation, to your calling. And I love it that those composers gathered together and they shared that idea that's what we're about. We're about something pretty astounding, even while we're still on this earth, that God has invited us to be his partners now. And so like when your guys group get together, I want you to encourage each other, because there are no little people, there are no little places who need that sort of a vision about life. C.S. Lewis. I love this. At one point, he was complaining about the guy who herded sheep coming and sitting in the aisle across from him. The guy came in with muddy wellies. You know what wellies are? The green boots for going through mud. And the guy hadn't had a bath in a while. And so Lewis, I've been in his church there in Oxford, and I can almost picture him sitting there, and here's the guy not singing on key, and the guy comes in with his muddy boots and smells. And you know how you can kind of sit there and get critical of other people? Oh, you don't do that? And Lewis found himself getting critical, going, you know, come on, why doesn't the guy scrape his boots off? You know, he needs a good bath. And then he goes home and he really thinks about it, and he writes this. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest, most interesting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all only in a nightmare. Listen. All day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities that we should conduct all of our dealings with one another. All friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. But it is immortals with whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. So before I drill this point home, I know we were all over the scriptures today. Let me back it up and put it all in context so that it's really clear what you're taking home. Paul is talking about the glory that really matters. Remember, he was constantly compared, Paul. You're not good enough. You're not smart enough. You maybe were somebody in your old days, but not any longer. You don't have glory. You don't have the right stuff any longer. And Paul comes back and says, no, you do not understand what God has been about. Here is the long arc of God's story. God is looking for partners. And the people, the children of Israel, failed him. Moses got to contain his glory for a little bit. And God put his glory in a structure and in a book. But now with Jesus in this new era, God has given us a new Adam, a new person through whom his glory can come. And while I may not look like much to you, I may be an old, broken man, but brothers and sisters, I am part of something incredible that God is doing, and it has started right now. So while this body may be fading away, that's not my whole story. My story started at the point where I gave my life to Jesus Christ, and it is going to continue on and on and on into eternity. And in the new heavens and the new earth, I will be joining him. And when we see him, we will see him with unveiled faces, nothing between us. And he will entrust his glory, his character, his power, his weight, his gravity over to us. And when we see each other in that day, it's going to be stunning. So when you look at each other this morning, don't look at each other just as mere mortals. Don't do that. Look at each other whom we are in the process of becoming. Because the glory of the God of the universe that created everything is resting, will be resting on you. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to look at somebody else. Not yet. Turn and look at somebody else. You don't have to say anything. But I want you to turn and make eye contact with a sense of, I see you. And in doing that, you are in essence saying, I see who you're becoming. Okay. It can be spouse. It can be somebody you maybe don't even like. But that's what I want you to do. Say, Mike, I see that you aren't just Mike living in Castro Valley. You are someone who is stunning in what God is going to be bringing about. You are more than your illness. You are more than your job. You are more than your location. And we will see him with unveiled faces. Let me pray. Father, may your spirit train the warp out of our lives. The impact of sin and the warpage that takes place as we walk with each other, as we pray together, as we're involved in mission together, may that warp become less and less pronounced as we live more and more into our truest identity. And I pray for the barbers, and I pray for the school teachers when they look at the kids who are in their class, that they not look at these kids as a problem or as a charmed kid. I pray for the people who are doing tech support, that when they talk to people on the phone, it wouldn't just be a client. Would you give all of us today that sense of, oh my goodness, we're part of the eternal work of God. He invites us to be partners living into our heavenly humanity. And we will be joining him. We will be joining him in the new heavens and the new earth without time. And God's people said, Amen.